From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made when a man decided to go home to visit his parents. He had purchased a rhinestone brooch earlier in the day. When his father found out, he insulted him. In describing the incident, the son wrote, quote, "Without going into too much detail, this encounter with my old man forced me to think about what it means to be a man and why it is so important that I convince myself, my dad, and anyone else that I am a man. Men, by traditional perspectives, are dangerous, oppressive creatures. I am a man is a statement that is worthy of living up to, and I am still trying to understand why," end quote. He shared this story as part of an exhibit that opens tomorrow at the Visual Studies Workshop entitled Evidence. Through photos and written testimonies, artist and photographer Joshua Rashad McFadden explores perceptions of Black masculinity and gender identity in modern America. It's an exhibit that's meant to generate conversations about the intersection of history, identity, and race, and it also includes the newspapers of Frederick Douglass. The contemporary men featured in McFadden's work are asked the questions, what does it mean to be a man? And what is freedom? Our guests this hour explore those questions and share their own thoughts and perspectives with us. And joining us in studio, welcome to Gatekeeper Adrian, an artist, activist, photographer, filmmaker, organizer, and founder and chair of Rochester Black Pride. Welcome back to the program.
Yes, thank you for having me. Peace and good morning.
Good morning. Good afternoon now.
Afternoon.
No problem. Brandon Stroud is here. Brandon is the owner and yoga instructor for Be Yourself Yoga and a residence coordinator at RIT. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Hi. Thank you, everyone.
And welcome to Jonathan Nthketha, who is the associate director of the Multicultural Center at RIT and a performance educator with Impact Interactive. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
First of all, we had a chance to go take a look at the exhibit this week before its formal opening tomorrow. Have you all had been in there? Have you had a chance to see it?
I haven't seen it.
It's moving. It's really, really moving and powerful, and just the written words. But let me kind of just start more broadly, and I'll start with Adrian. Mm-hmm. The question of what Black masculinity means is posed in this exhibit. Mm-hmm. How do you answer that question?
I'll start with this, I guess. I believe all things are a spectrum. So it's not just like a one or the other or mm-hmm. this or that kind of thing. Like it's a spectrum of things, and things are very fluid oftentimes. When I think about Black masculinity, I think more of like energy as opposed to like gender norms or kind of like societal things that society has set up to say, this is what a man should be, this is what a man is, da 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 da. And I really kind of look at it as an energy that in its healthiest form, I think, takes the roles of being many things, so supportive, protective, uplifting, focused, powerful, and again, many of these mirror feminine energy as well. I know a lot of the conversation now is really around like toxic masculinity and how we get rid of that and really pointing out those things. And I think we actually have an opportunity to really chart a new course and figure out redefining these things and defining what these things actually look like in a healthy manner. So I'm still kind of working that out, figuring that out, and kind of exploring what that could mean for a better future for everyone.
Do you think some people are threatened by the idea that masculinity is not as narrow as it has long traditionally been defined?
Absolutely. I think most people are threatened by the idea of change. Human beings do not do well with change. And I think we have to really look at and investigate the toxicness of patriarchy overall and how much of its existence is rooted in the oppression of everything that's not that. And so I think when we think about, we talk about people being threatened by changing this narrative, it's really changing everything that they know or everything they've been taught. And, you know, that's when cognitive dissonance plays in and kicks in with most people. And really also opening up people's minds as well in terms of like, your perspective isn't the only one, nor is it like the supreme one, you know?
Mm-hmm. Let me turn to Brandon. Just initial thoughts on how society perhaps has defined Black masculinity and how you view it.
I think a lot of things now that we're looking at has been surrounded by D-Wade's daughter now, Zaya. Mm-hmm. And that has opened my eyes to see a lot of things and how we as Black men or Black male bodies see ourselves and see each other in these different spaces. It is really hard to see sometimes. Like, what are people really saying about each other inside of the Black community? And knowing that that's been rooted in so much of the history of just Black men being in America as well. I often think about buck busting, which we don't like to talk about in the Black community or in American history anywhere, of how like Black men were the first to be raped in slavery. When we see most of the things that are depicted, it's mainly women and young girls who are being raped and assaulted. But buck busting was a thing. And for a lot of us who actually know our history and understand that, we can recognize why the hatred towards Black men who may be more effeminate and where that comes from and how people interact with those individuals and why they interact those ways. Because of fear, because of the lack of power that may be taken away from your body, and how power and privilege plays a role in everything that we do, like in all of our roles that we have as like brothers, sisters, fathers, uncles, like whatever people may see you as. And understanding sometimes how to maneuver outside of that, I think, gets a lot of Black men or Black male identified bodies like stuck in imposter syndrome, because they have nowhere to go and they really can't find themselves to be those free beings in which they want to be.
You mentioned Dwayne Wade, former NBA star, one of the greatest basketball players of all time, and yes, is raising a trans girl. Mm-hmm. Who I recently saw Dwayne said that they knew when she was three that she was trans. Mm-hmm. And the amount of support, I mean, this sounds maybe like I'm going to say something really clumsy here, but it sounds strange that this would even be a discussion about whether there would be support for the parents, support for the family. But he took a lot of junk, and I'm censoring myself, on social media just with the discussion about his trans daughter. And you referencing D-Wade makes me wonder, how significant is sort of a high profile parent like D-Wade to this moment? How important is that?
I think right now, like, he's challenging everything that we knew about parenthood and about Black fatherhood and about Black masculinity. Like, he's been posting like, oh, I've always been getting my nails done, like, you all just didn't know that. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that puts into play of we all live different lifestyles, and we all, and I hate the word lifestyles anyway, we all just live our lives differently. Mm-hmm. And within being around different people, I think he's really setting the precedent of like how parents should treat their queer-bodied children. Because for the longest, children either were hiding in the closet. I like to say now we're stepping into our own identities. So we don't have to hide in closets. We can step into who we're meant to be instead of stepping out of a closet. And I think he's stepping in who he's meant to be as a father role and as a role model inside of our community for so many people who actually do look up to him. And I think he's challenging people to think outside of that. And you see how people are responding to him and saying like, oh, he's going overboard now. And there was even a comment by a rapper who was talking about the child's genitalia. And it's like, nowhere did this man mention anything about genitalia. And for so many people, they're like, well, you have to have had sex or something to engage and know this about yourself. And it's like, no. People know who they are, and I think people discredit people when people give them their truth by questioning, like, is that really you? Is this really who you want to become? How do you know? And it's like, well, how did you know who were you supposed to become? Like, even as adults, we recognize every day, like, we're becoming somebody new. And that's who we're supposed to be. And it might be different from who we were yesterday. And some of those days may turn back into who we were yesterday, you know? And I think that that's okay to be fluid and live a life that's like, I'm open to this change, and I'm open to creating change for myself and for others to recognize it's okay for us to accept others who may be different than us.
Jonathan Nethketha, how do you view the question of what black masculinity means?
First off, snaps. Just snaps. It's wonderful to be in this space and sharing this space with my family members, and then also my sons are in the green room or the waiting room, hopefully not tearing it apart. And I tell you, I think being a father changed everything. I have two young boys, and I'll put it this way: growing up, everyone always made you feel as a black man that you were, there was two things that you could be, and you were either this or you were that, and that was it. So grew up with the identity of and the idea of black masculinity being a coin, and it's always a flip of the coin, who you're going to be, and what, you know, how thuggish you're going to be, how white or black you're going to be, how mm-hmm. gay or straight you're going to be, whatever it is. It was just a coin. And then the more you live, the more you see the world, the more you meet people, and more importantly, the more you listen to other people's realities, you start to realize that your identity is not a coin. It's more like a dice. It's like six sides. And you're thinking, wow, there's so many other sides I haven't explored yet. And I'm at the point now, and shout out to all the people who play Dungeons and Dragons, where I realize identity is like a 64-sided die at this point. And as Brandon mentioned, you can keep coming back to something that you used to exhibit or a way that you used to identify, because that roll of the die is that's you. And our job in life is to explore every piece of who we are and understand it for ourselves. And the notion that we have to put a tag on who a black man can be is the problem. We don't own our bodies, and we don't feel comfortable owning who we are and what our experiences are, what we think, how we feel, and how we interact with other people. And the more that we continue in this existence today, the more I see that we're always pushing that conversation to the side. So I celebrate every black male who is identifying who they are and trying to figure it out. And the parents like Dwayne Wade and like so many others who give space to their children to be able to be who they are. And it's not just the millionaires. It's not just the people with means and the ability. It's the reality is that this is something we all deal with. But just like family business, we don't all talk about it. Right. So that is the part that I wish to explore further is, especially as my kids get older, I start to realize that what I put into the energy of who they are, that is a part of their developing masculinity. And I'm responsible for what I imprint upon them. So if my son says, hey, I want these, the one son says he wants black headphones, the other one says he wants rose gold headphones. It's a color. It's a nice color, and that's a color that he likes. Do I have to put into it everything that the world is telling me? Because the world shapes everything with this lens of sexuality and sex. And these are children. This is nothing that's a part of their identity. So the more that we as adults who have not done the work of exploring who we were and how we were raised, the more that we put those onto this current generation and these children, that's not fair. Let them develop. Let them explore. We support them and love them. And that's our calling as parents, as elders, as uncles, as family members, and just people in this community. So black identity and masculinity, it's so multifaceted that we do it a disservice every time we try to minimize and polarize and say what it is or what it isn't.
Let me welcome the artist. Joshua Rashad McFadden is here, the visual artist who is behind this exhibit, which opens tomorrow again. At the exhibition is happening from the 21st through June 27th. So you got a chance to see it, and that's at 31 Prince Street, by the way. The gallery is there. The admission is free. You have a chance to see it. Welcome. Thank you for being here, by the way.
Thank you for having me.
Well, and we get right on, Joshua, get right on your microphone so we can hear you nice and clear. So why don't you tell me what inspired this work in the first place here?
Well, can everybody hear me?
We can.
Okay. Well, I've been exploring this idea of masculinity and identity construction and black men or people who identify may identify as black men or not for about 5 years now with my past work, Come to Selfhood, and then building up into Evidence.
And we were talking just at the outset of this program about how powerful the exhibit is. Had a chance to see it this week and again opening for the public tomorrow. What are you hoping the public takes from it?
Well, I hope the public comes to the exhibit with an open mind mm-hmm. and ready to read the narratives and take in the information from each young person that participated. And come to the exhibit not ready to place everyone into one category. The purpose of the exhibit is to display and convey the idea that there's many different types of personalities, identities, and ways of expressing oneself as a Black person in America.
Going to get to some feedback in just a moment. Rich, hang there for a second. But watching Adrian's reaction, they had this visceral reaction when Jonathan is talking about, you know, it's not just the millionaire parents. It's not just Dwayne Wade, you know, and we can celebrate this moment where here's a high-profile parent mm-hmm. on a big stage allowing space for a child to be who they are. And that is one thing. But, Adrian, I just want to ask about, you know, just your reaction, and it wasn't just the millionaire. Do you feel that it's almost easier for the D. Wade's of the world to be in that space now because D. Wade's essentially protected, there's money, there's status, it's not as easy, I don't want to interpret your reaction, so I want you to explain.
Well, definitely class always has to be a part of the conversation because being rich definitely makes you a lot more insulated from a lot of the things that normal folks come across, and especially as a Black person in different classes, if you're poor and you're Black versus if you're rich and you're Black, those are two very different experiences that you have. But also just my own experience, you know, I never like to, while the Black community in general has an air of homophobia and transphobia about it, it's like it's also a reflection of the larger society that we live in, right? And so while a lot of our things are social things, you know, there are still structural things in place which we have no voice in that also perpetuate homophobia, transphobia, racism, all these things. But also a lot of the people that I've come across in just my own life and the people I do work with and are in my tribe, like we all make space for so many people, and they are not the people who have, not, they probably don't even own a house, or they this, that, and the third, you know, they don't have millions and millions of dollars at their disposal, but you know, they make space for other people to identify however you have. And it's, I think sometimes it's whether or not folks are given the language to do these things. And I also want to point out how D. Wade was, how someone like him, how space was made for him to even do that. And that is the work and the legacy of the Marsha P. Johnsons of the world, of the Sylvia Riveras, the Miss Majors, like all the folks who were poor and Black and who have always been doing this work and have been pushing for these changes, and now space is open to make it comfortable for folks like him to do this thing and to kind of make this space for his child, because now he's, like, I remember he was on Ellen and he was talking about, you know, I had to do my research. And it's like there are people who have done that work to make that research and that information available to you. So mm-hmm. I always shout out and applaud, specifically my Black trans women who've been saving our lives since day one.
Let me get Rich on the phone from Rochester first up. Go ahead, Rich.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, sir.
This is such a good conversation, an important one, especially in the Black community. And I know some of your guests have already touched on it. The problems with the hyper-masculinity that goes on, and with that, this need to guard that masculinity almost at all costs. People like Dwayne Wade, and let us not forget Magic Johnson came out 4 to 5 years ago about his son. Mm-hmm. And supporting his son and allowing his son to be who he is. We have to figure out a way in these spaces, especially for our, you know, within the Black community, for men to be able to express this stuff and not to be a, you know, like just a condemnation of their masculinity. And also, I keep hearing another thing that I push back against is this thing that, well, these are the ways, these people are born this way and they have no choice. And to my mind, it doesn't matter that they're born this way or if it is a choice or not. If it's a choice, so what? You have the right to choose who you want to be and how you want to be and define who you are, regardless of what some standard is. And we have to even get past that language of, well, you know, it's like being Black, you know, you can't help it if you're gay or transgender. Who cares That should not be the define. I don't think that's the way this conversation needs to be defined or should be defined. And that's just from my point of view on part of this.
Rich, thanks for the phone call. Joshua, the artist, you want to start with a response to that?
A response?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I appreciate everything he just said. Mm-hmm. So thanks for the comment.
Okay. Anybody else want to add to that?
I want to tap in. I think I do agree that it shouldn't matter whether you choose something or this, that, and the third. It should not matter. I think where it is super important is whether or not people are safe to do those things.
Right.
And so, again, it's less about people aren't really concerned about whether someone was born away or they identify away. It's like, why isn't there space for me to be whoever I am? And especially for Black queer and Black trans people in particular, you know, there's a significant level of danger that comes with living your life authentically. And that doesn't matter whether you're in a white space, whether you're in a Black space, but it's like people's lives are on the line. You know, over almost 30 Black trans women were murdered for just being who they were last year. I just saw one of my friends posted a post like this one man burned down this Black trans woman's home just because she was trans. And he said, I don't like this, and so I'm going to burn down your house. And the thought that folks have to even decide between whether I'm going to live my life authentically or whether I'm going to survive till tomorrow.
Right.
That, I think, is the crux of this conversation.
Yeah, and to that point, in talking to young Black trans men and women, I've seen those things. I've seen where I know one who has perfectly beautiful teeth except for the one that got knocked out because someone assaulted him. Mm-hmm. That's so heartbreaking. You don't even know what to do with the pain. That even as a human being, empathizing the pain I feel, I can't even imagine the pain he feels. Or she feels at this point in their lives, and how unsafe they must feel. It's just, it's got to, I don't know what to do, but it's got to stop. And I think these conversations and challenging this stuff, I find myself almost having a one-man war on Facebook against this stuff. I challenge especially my Black male friends. When I see it, I challenge them. I call them out on it.
Well, Rich, I'm sorry, Rich. I just want to jump in and say, I think that is probably worth exploring a little bit more is what are the expectations for everyone in a society where we want everyone to be safe and authentic? And to Adrian's point about safety, how often do you feel unsafe? I know it's a naive and ignorant question.
It's a question that I really just kind of, it just depends. Like I have my mechanisms and how I move through the world. Mm-hmm. Because of who I am in this community, I feel a little more safe just because people kind of know who I am and mm-hmm. kind of the work that I do. So it's a lot easier for me. How safe do I feel other places? And like, I mean, it's hit or miss. Like at any given point in time, there's this air around me that I can be taken out at any given moment in time because someone don't like these heels I got on. Someone don't like the way I'm dressed. Someone don't like this. They don't like the high-pitchedness in my voice, the switch in my walk, whatever the case may be. And at any given point, there's always that air around it. I just think I put my focus elsewhere because I have the privilege to put my focus elsewhere, and that's not one of the larger concerns I have. At the same time, the people I love, the people who live in my neighborhoods and my areas, and a lot of the youth that I work with, I know it's terrifying for them.
Right.
Every single day. And so much of my focus goes to how can I make more space for them to be who they are.
Part of the reason I asked the question of just sort of a perception of safety is if there is sort of an evolutionary kind of step-by-step process, this notion of just take homosexuality, just take same-sex marriage in this country, mm-hmm. where still a third of this country says they don't want same-sex marriage, but it was a third of this country that did support it 15 years ago. So if there's this idea that the first challenge is coming out for those who want to live authentically, mm-hmm. and then sort of seeing societal acceptance. Tolerance is a word that I think we are sort of moving past. I mean, we don't want to be in a society that we just where we tolerate each other. But if that is part of this process, and then to eventually then feel that you can live authentically and not ever feel unsafe, I mean, it probably feels light years away at this point. But I guess what I'm asking is, where do you think that continuum is, where we might be? I mean, by some surveys, American adults age 18 to 24 self-identify as queer at something like 4 to 5 times the rate of self-identification of queer as adults who are 25 and older. So there's certainly more of an embracing of self and identity that's happening for younger adults. And I'm sure it feels like we're a long way away from where a society needs to be. But I mean, are we in the infancy, Adrian? I mean, do you think are significant steps happening that you can sort of feel and perceive?
Are significant steps happening? Yes. I wouldn't even call this like the infancy stage. Like, we haven't even begun to scratch the surface of what this can look like. Because again, it's very much like these conversations are great. At the same time, I met this kid in high when I went to one of the schools, and I remember, you know, he came in and was talking to him, and he's like, "Yeah, my parents don't know I'm out," and I'm just like, I'm sitting here looking at this child in this crop top and these poom poom shorts, and I said, "Child, now how in the world?" And he said he walked me through his whole process of how he even gets off, like he wakes up in the morning, has a change of clothes in his bag, and he goes through this whole process to live his life, but also not confronting that thing of like, my parents will kick me out, my parents will probably try to assault me, my parents will probably try to do this. And so again, I think the narrative may be changing, and people love talking, like we love these conversations, we love arguing on Facebook. At the same time, when I step outside my door, when I put down my phone, what is the environment that I'm in?
Right.
How are people treating me? What kind of spaces am I allowed access to? Who do I see reflected in government and TV? I mean, ain't nobody black running for president. Not currently right now. Right. And so it's like we are light years away from even trying to see someone black and queer, black and trans, being at the level that they are. And I guess the high hyper level, because there have been trans people who have run for president. But it's at the level, and to get that level of support and that level of visibility. But even one of my biggest critiques of like the passing of gender versus the passing of same-sex marriage, like how did same-sex marriage beat people's ability to live, work, and survive? How was that? How was someone's ability to marriage, and marriage is a whole system in and of itself that has a level of privilege attached to it. How did that beat out queer and trans people being able to get a job, to live a place, and do this? And why did it take go to the bathroom? And that's still a thing.
Right.
That is literally still a thing. People are still being pulled out of bathrooms today. So we got a long stretch marathon to go.
Brandon, you want to add to that?
I think it's interesting sitting beside Adrian, because thinking about safety, like I think my Brister and I have like been in situations where we were just living our lives. Like the first thing I thought about was safety was like we were out in Toronto for different occasions. one was New Year's, and one of our more effeminate bodied sisters in the community was with us, and because of their attire, these people in the hotel like stopped when we walked in the hotel, and we were looking really cute. Like we was fly. We were really fly that night. And a statement was made to them, and the first thing Adrian and I did was, first of all, they handled the situation themselves, like to defuse. And
shout
Adrian and I was there, and it was like a swoop in method, because we didn't know. Like, we weren't near home. We were in a hotel as guests. So at any point in time, they see these black queer bodies in this space, and maybe they think like, oh, they're about to start trouble. And it was like, no, but they started with us. And how in that time could we create safety for ourselves in that space? And then the other time was when we were out at a club in Toronto. I think it was the Afrobeats and Soca party we had to. And Adrian and I were dancing, like, enjoying ourselves, living. And then you could see the other black bodies who were clearly queer identifying, like, wait, what is going on? like, we can be this free. And, like, nobody bothered us. Like, everybody was so sweet in that instant, right? I was like, oh, my gosh, like, who are these people? Like, where did... Literally saying this, y'all must be from America because we don't do that over here. And so we were just like, oh, okay. And even thinking about an incident when I was out with my partner and, like, people have said things and my partner is this, like, bigger guy. Like, when you see him, he's, like, big, broly dude. And so he's, like, also this giant, like, just beautiful being. And we talk about those differences a lot. To where I may respond, and he was like, babe, you can't respond like that. And I was like, well, I'm gonna fight for both of us or something, like, you know, like, like, I'm gonna call people, I'm gonna do whatever. And so that's my first instinct, where his first instinct of safety of, we don't even have to acknowledge them and still be safe in our own bodies and still keep it pushing, where mine is like, if somebody comes over here and starts some trouble with me or my man, like, I'm ready to go, like, and that, but that's been the mindset that I've had to grow up in because of the spaces of, because, like, being at high school parties and getting jumped, being in college and getting jumped, like, joining a fraternity and, like, even thinking about what the space of Black fraternities have done inside of our community and be like, I'm gonna be this, like, Bayard Rustin is one of my fraternity brothers, and I follow in his greatness of just trying to be free. And then you recognize, like, this man had to be in so much peace in his mind, body, and soul at all times to sit there and be like, okay, this is fine. My friends are stuffing me in the back of a car trunk so that people will be a part of this bus boycott movement. And so if I'm there, my presence is going to do something to them. And so, like, living in that duality of, like, knowing that your presence is either going to be this great respected thing and people see you as this beautiful being and creature moving throughout the world. And then other times you have to be like, okay, if I'm riding through whatever neighborhood, do I have to throw my head up or do I need to nod towards them? Because that those head nods can mean two different things when it comes to safety, like just existing in me, like, okay, we're going to do this. Mm. And like living in that and still being like, okay, I'm a little scared right now. I don't know what's really going to happen, but like, we're going to make it work.
Jonathan, how do we respond to Rich's comment when he talks about, well, he will jump in on Facebook, he will mix it up, he will stand up and sort of address it and call it out when he sees those kind of discriminatory comments but what is the sort of the mindset of being I guess. If we overuse the word ally, but really being
co-conspirator.
Co-conspirator?
Yeah, I like that.
I'm gonna follow Adrian's lead there, but co-conspirator? Yeah. What's the mindset?
I too have begun to adopt that term, co-conspirator, because we need to address what is happening and the systems that are at play. And I think what Rich is talking about and what many of the people that we share connections to have spoken about is this need to take it personally. Like, you have to take this personally. Everyone has to understand that you know someone who is trans. You know someone who is queer, who identifies as queer. You know someone. You're related to someone. You love someone. You've worked for someone. You've played sports with someone. Mm-hmm. It is a part of our reality. And I think back to now working at a university where I see students coming already having made a transition, not even just questioning and being able to figure out what this means, but coming to university, having started their transition or made it. And I go back to my time in the late 90s, or as my sons call it, the late 1900s, where it's true, though. They're not wrong. Where I think about all of my friends in high school and college who maybe identified as such, but there was no space for it. And I take responsibility for my role in that. Sure, I listened. Sure, I was available. There was not the discourse and the discussion, but we have to try and endeavor to be good people, because when we know that it's happening to someone and we understand that it is as close as 1 degree away from us, we then have to take responsibility for our actions and what we do, and what we say, and how we treat people. Because the way that we look side-eyed at someone without acknowledging what the difference is, that makes us complicit in the system that we are fighting against in other areas of our life. And we're talking about, like I said, the 64-sided die, and we've been on a couple of sides in this conversation, Black masculinity is so much more. Mm-hmm. Yet we are only relegated. Everything that someone is going to see about a gatekeeper, Adrian, is the heels. Mm-hmm. Are they going to look at the fact that the vision, the eyes, the way in which he sees the world is something that we can grow from, we can learn from, we can inspire to contribute to? No, we're going to stop at something so minute. And if we can accept that there is so much more, we can start to make space for the fullness of Black masculinity. And I was talking with Brandon a little bit about this as well. We always talk about when you're in the working world, you can never be at a 10. Mm-hmm. Like, to be your fullness mm-hmm. on that dance floor, I can't be completely 100% myself, upset, impassioned, whatever it might be, in work. Because if I get above a 5 or a 6, someone might think that, I'm a little scared of Jonathan. It's a little bit too much. Maybe he's a little unhinged. Something's wrong. And when everything that I can do has to be muted to fit into a box, I start to rebel against self mm-hmm. and I rebel against the other people who are close to me. And I know, I've acknowledged that I've hurt other people by way of just being tired of this system. And that is the sin that we're all complicit in. But when we conspire to do better, we see each other not just as allies, but as brothers, sisters, family members who are walking on our own paths. And we intersect at times, we diverge at others. But as long as we are giving the space for others, we have full space for ourselves to be.
After our only break of the hour, I want to read some of the words that you'll encounter at the exhibit that I think exemplify some of the struggle that is on display and some of the questions about Black masculinity at a visual art exhibition that you can find launching tomorrow at the Visual Studies Workshop, the gallery at 31 Prince Street, and also locations to be announced and listed online and posted on Twitter and Instagram. There's going to be a lot going on. But starting tomorrow, you can see it in that space at the VSW at 31 Prince Street. And you just heard Jonathan Nethketha, who is Associate Director of the Multicultural Center at RIT, Brandon Stroud, owner and a yoga instructor for Be Yourself Yoga and a residence coordinator at RIT. Gatekeeper Adrian is with us, an artist, activist, photographer, filmmaker, organizer, and founder and chair of Rochester Black Pride. And Joshua Rashad McFadden is a visual artist. And let's get that only break, and we'll come back and hear more of the words of the people featured in the exhibit next. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on The Next Connections, we're joined first hour by Nate McMurray, the Democrat running for Congress a second time. He challenged Chris Collins the last time before Chris Collins was sent to prison. In our second hour on Friday, a conversation about authenticity. What is it? And in particular, how do you know what's authentic on Instagram, on Twitter, on Facebook? Talk with you on Friday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. So let me read some of the words written by one of the men featured in the exhibit that you can find at the Visual Studies Workshop as we talk about evidence and conversations and portraits and words on Black masculinity. These are some of the words. Quote, "I am a man. The first thing I think about are the negative implications. I don't cry. I'm a man. I don't take answers from a woman. I'm a man. No, let me take care of that because I'm a man. I hate that becoming a man means I have to deny emotions. Emotions are weak, and men are not. Don't cry because only bitches cry. Instead of crying, be angry. Go to the gym. Box. Go have a beer. Don't talk about your problems to your boys because they don't want to hear that. Now, women, they cry." End quote. Can I ask all of our guests just first thoughts on that? Adrian?
How, like, 1940s of them. I mean, like, I understand it, but it's just like, wow, like, that's that mindset that person is kind of trapped in that box, like, that was set how long ago? Like, oh my God, like, that's, and it's just, it's heartbreaking in that way. It's just heartbreaking to hear it. I see the realities of that and so many folks trapped in that. I'm thinking about now one of my homegirls. She recently had posted, I think like yesterday, she was like, she has a son. He's like 4 years old. And she was like, when he was like a little kid, like, he used to love all the colors. Like, if it was pink, he used to love the color pink and all these other things. She was like, the second I sent him to school, he came back home and pink just wasn't a thing. Like he couldn't be associated with pink. And I'm like, so much of our world is literally set up to not only teach but reinforce these notions where literally people, and you spoke beautifully to it, like just they're just trapped in this thing, and like they can't even, they got to be at a two or three, or I can't go past this level, I can't be vulnerable, I can't do this thing. And I'm just like, it's just so it's just heartbreaking. And then I think about, it's heartbreaking.
The conclusion of the words of the man I was just quoting from the exhibit, he concludes after all that with, I hate toxic masculinity. And I think the mindset that he was quoting at the top is what is instilled, or he felt was instilled or taught to him about who gets to show emotion, what it means to be a man. Brandon, what do you think?
Yeah, I think it sounds like he needs some yoga. But no, like, even in my quest and understanding what yoga was and how it's been infiltrated into the Black community since like the 1975s when it first got introduced, it was a different type of yoga, Kundalini yoga, and it was really about breathing and really being inside of your body. And it was like so euphoric that people would be like, oh, okay, like we're in a different state right now. And like even seeing that power of yoga, of working, I really started doing yoga with my Black male students on campus. Like we were having private meditation sessions and all of that. And these would be the things that we could discuss, that they would see this Black queer identifying male as still as a brother figure, still as a mentor, and like come over and have those opportunities to talk with me. And understand that, like, we're taking care of each other in this moment, you know? And so I think that hate for the toxic masculinity and what he was talking about, like, not being able to talk to your homeboys or your friends about it, I think now we actually do see a different narrative. Like, there's been articles talking about how, like, men appreciate their bromances more than they actually do their actual relationships, because they're just like, these are my boys. There's even rappers out here saying, like, I tell the truth to my homies, but I lie to my girl. And I think that piece right there shows, like, that toxicness of, like, why can't you just tell everybody the truth? Like, why can't you just exist in your truth consistently all the time? And I think that goes to, like, the imposter syndrome of what he was beginning to talk about at the beginning of, like, this is what I have to do to be able to take care of her, of my significant other, and things like that. Think about old school songs like Papa Was a Rolling Stone, like all these different things that have set up ideals and ideologies with inside of the community showcase. Like, people really want to be good, but there's something inside of them, fear of themselves, that they have to, like, to be like, okay, we got to hide this. And I recognize it for myself. Like, my father's a Southern pastor. And so, like, I know my mom knows who my partner is, because I talk about this person to her all the time. Like, I talk about him all the time. Shout out to Bay. Hey, Dante. But even in that, like, recognizing for me, I'm protecting us, because she knows who he is, but she's not really ready there to fully accept, like, okay, this is what's occurring. But I see her with the baby steps, and it's like, okay, she's going to get there one day. But what do I do as a son? Do I protect both my partner and my mother as I see it, of being like, okay, this is just how I can exist and love everybody right now, and it's a beautiful thing for me to exist in, and recognizing, like, I'm grown. My parents ain't got to know all my business, and, like, that's kind of how it was portrayed. And now, as you see people getting older, like, I don't want to lose my children. So what do I have to do to see my grandkids? What do I have to do to just see my children and, like, be present in their lives? And for a lot of people, that's hard, because women also have ideologies that are rooted in toxic masculinity and, like, uphold those standards. And we don't like to talk about, like, how women talk about or may treat their queer sons. Like, it's women out here who'll be abusive to their queer children just as men will be, you know? And so recognizing that everybody has some holds and restraints and what's this toxic masculinity and what is doing to everybody. Like, everybody has have lived experiences in that, and we all have to be willing to break that, or either protect ourselves in different realms of being like, okay, these people may not be able to meet right now, but my hopes and goals is that one day they will be able to. And so how am I living in my truth to do that, and also recognizing that if people aren't comfortable with meeting in those spaces, like, it's okay. Everybody ain't got to love everybody. Everybody ain't got to see everybody. Everybody doesn't have to meet everybody. And that's okay, because you still want to exist how you want to exist. And all of the family can't be around one another at times. You know, everybody can't exist, because if you know that somebody else is may attack this other person that's with you, like, don't put people in those spaces. And like, that's what he's talking about, of like, we got to break out of these spaces so we're not putting other people into those spaces.
Yes. Jonathan?
The clearest thought is that we are not responsible for what happened to us, but we are responsible for what we pass along.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we are not at fault if we were abused, if we were mistreated, if we were told to man up, if we were beaten because we wearing a girly, we liked something girly, whatever. Mm-hmm. We're not at fault for that. But it has to stop at some place. You know, and there's a system that we're a part of when we pass along a lot of this trauma. And when we do that, we're responsible for that.
Mm-hmm.
So when I look at my children and they want to cry, I encourage them to. And we cry. And there was one episode in our family's life, it's not on television yet, but where my wife came upstairs like, what is going on? Because we were just in the boys' room and we just needed to get stuff out. And my youngest was just crying. And it was like, he's getting it out and he's being in touch with it. And that's, as an actor, that's one of the things that you can't unlock, that sort of more gamer language, that section of the map until you get there. Right, you don't know what's available. And so once you explore it and you tap into what it's like to really hurt or to really emote or to really love, you can get back there easily. And that's a part of everything that you do moving forward. So the more we tell our children not to cry, the more we tell our children not to feel or connect, the further away from true connections we are forcing them. And so it is heartbreaking. It is the truth that we need to break all of those things. Mm-hmm. But we all have to ask ourselves, what are we passing along? And as Brandon mentioned, you know, a lot of the older generation, they're faced with the reality of, I want to see my grandkids, so I have to confront this. And there's always a point at which we come to terms with what we've done and how we've treated others.
Mm-hmm.
And for those of us who have continuously dealt with this oppression from people we love and those we don't know, you know, we may not be ready when you're ready. We just have to hope and do our best. So I hope that the families, members I love and care for, that they will be around and that they will want to still connect with me. And I have to make sure that I'm ready whenever anyone in my life is ready to chat with me and open up and be honest.
Well, one more question for Brandon, because, you know, as you mentioned, if you're taught certain things as a child, it's not your fault that you're taught that.
Mm-hmm.
But at some point, there has to be sort of accountability as we become adults and sort of express ideas. And, you know, sort of the little bit trite but often true expression, hurt people hurt people.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You talk about being jumped. You talk about knowing that, you know, in certain spaces, you have to be sort of have an eye on what may be a threat to you. The people who would do that, the people who would literally jump you for what you're wearing, or the clothes you're wearing, or wearing heels, or looking great to my eyes,
fabulous.
To them, yeah, fabulous. There you go. But Brandon, just real briefly, in our last 90 seconds or so, do you wonder what happened to someone they get to the point where they literally are going to cause physical harm to someone?
I think you wonder, what traumatizing experiences have you gone through? And I think that's what really led me to yoga, like recognizing I've gone through my own trauma, recognizing that my brothers and sisters, family, and everybody's going through trauma. Like, now my mom is into yoga. Like, everybody in my life is like really about like this mindfulness and this yoga, like, or just anything that's dealing with like, let me break free. And so having conversations with students who may see me and be like, oh, that's Auntie B, or like, that's Mr. B, whatever they want to call me. And then knowing that I have something that I can give them for them to break free and like have those conversations, because people will tell you what happened to them. Mm-hmm. And like, even with some of my family members, they be like, I don't think they forget that I'm queer, but they are just like, oh, okay. Like, my God family here, when my God brother literally told me, he was like, we needed you and you needed us. And that was like one of the truest statements of like, seeing this black masculine figure like him, I was just like, wow, like that was so deep for him to say to me and for us to engage in conversations like I've been hurt and we've been hurt and how we hurt other people and like not trying to hurt other people, just being like, you have so much built up in your body that you can't release it. And like finding ways to release that. And like, literally, everybody knows I put on free yoga classes for people just in our black community so that people can feel that and so that they can feel like my black masculine and feminine energy exuding and leading through, like leading them to their own personal freedoms in those moments.
All right, since we're going to wrap here, where is your yoga class?
So actually, I have a class tonight at Yoga for a Good Hood, which is where we have our teacher training there, led by Pastor Imani O'Lear. And it's at 111 North Chestnut Street. I teach there every Thursday from 6:30 to 7:30. And you can also visit my personal website at beyoselfyoga.com and schedule your own free personal in-house session. So, yeah.
Brendan, thanks for being here. Adrian, thank you.
Yes. Can I just throw in here lastly real quick?
About 15 seconds.
Tight. I got you. Breaking out the idea about masculinity and why I view it as an energy, because it's not rooted to just the male gender. Mm-hmm. And so that's like part two of a conversation for another time.
Thank you for being here. Mm-hmm. Jonathan Nathakesa, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Artists had to go attend to something. Joshua Rashad McFadden's work you can find at the Visual Studies Workshop starting tomorrow, Prince Street, called Evidence. Thanks, Josephine. Megan, we'll talk to you tomorrow.